Think about a social context. It could be the kitchen, it could be the bedroom, it could be the bus to school, it could be the cafeteria or the classroom. Everything is a social context if there are other people involved. And so when I walk into the classroom, if I don't see myself in there, oh, nobody looks like me, there's no pictures on the wall that looks like me, and they all look like somebody else, and I don't fit in here. And my brain is telling me that because my brain wants to fit in and wants to be part of and wants to be at least accepted.
Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast. This is Janine Ledford, your host and the creator of the groundbreaking concept of intercultural creativity, which is the intersection of creative thinking and cultural competence. So if you're looking for new, exciting ways to build a positive culture of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that sparks creativity, this is your place. We have exciting guests in all types of fields who highlight how creative thinking best thrives in a culture of diverse collaboration. At the Create and Grow podcast, you'll discover how inclusion drives innovation. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast. I am so excited to be back with you, bringing to you yet another neuroscientist. You know, I love my brain research, bringing you one of the top minds in neuroscience, but cognitive neuroscience. How are we thinking? How do we learn? And what's going on under the hood? I have with me Dr. Kiran Omani with me, and I am so excited to bring his work, to bring his observations and just some amazing ways of us to re-engage and re-see the students and the team members that we serve. I am a student of his, and I consider him a mentor of mine, and I look forward for you just to be opening your mind map and learning new ways to engage with those around us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Janine. It's really good to be here. Good to see you again.
Yes, yes. I am a true fan. I have one of your books, The Brain-Centric Design, with me. As you can see, it is highly tabbed through and highly highlighted. I don't know if you can see that.
Yes, you can see that.
And I am going to dive into that with you a little bit. But first, could you give our audience a little bit about how you got to be where you are today?
Yeah, it's a crazy story because I'm from Ireland and I came to America in 1982 for one weekend and I'm still here. So that was a long weekend. And not only that, but it was such a shock for me to find out that the solutions I thought I would find in America were not here. And in fact, I was a little bit naive. I was younger, of course. And what I was trying to solve was, why would a student in my classroom at age 13 commit suicide? A boy in my classroom. And I've been teaching for 10 years and I didn't see it coming. I wasn't prepared for it. And I didn't understand why a kid could do that. The engagement level in the schools was pretty bad. And the teaching I thought was okay, but I wasn't sure. And that confirmed for me that I wasn't a good teacher or anybody else, because we were all suffering from the same thing. In that month in my village where I grew up, there was a lot of suicides, boys and girls at age 11, 12, 13, 14. It was just unbelievable. So I thought, okay, any place that has life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you must know the answer for that. Well, I come here thinking I could ask the right people. And I came to the University of Washington and I asked, and they looked at me like, are you kidding me? It's worse here than there. And sure enough, yeah, it is. And it's more complicated here because it's such a melting pot of cultures and ethnicities, etc. And at least I had come from a country where everybody was the same back then. Now it's not, but back then it was. And I decided I'd stay around a little bit and investigate more. And I got involved in a program called LIFE, which is learning in informal and formal environments. It was the very first science of learning center from the National Science Foundation. And it was at the University of Washington where I was. And I went in there as a candidate, and I worked for 10 years with that program. And I thought, okay, we've got Stanford, SRI, University of Washington, and iLabs, which is a brain science lab. And, you know, 50 great minds and $50 million and 10 years to study this. We're bound to get the answer. And at the end of it, zero, nothing. Absolutely nothing. I wrote a paper with John Bransford, who was my mentor, and he passed away 2 weeks ago, sadly. And he was my great mentor. And the paper itself was the pedagogic model, which was the beginning of where we are today. And when I came out of that program, I thought, well, maybe there is no answer. Maybe I was naive even more. And as I was finishing up the paper and we were closing down the office, the miracle happened. And out of left field came two nurses from the School of Nursing. Now, who would have thought that we could solve education from the School of Nursing? That's the piece that was really weird. And they said to me, we need a learning scientist, because I'm a learning scientist. And at that point, they needed somebody to liaison between the neuroscientists and medical people into the school system, because their question was, $5 million for 5 years to study, what was the impact of marijuana and cocaine and alcohol on adolescent brain? And I thought, whoa, I've got a teenager son at home. I need to know that myself. And I thought it's an interesting question. And I signed up as a co-PI in that project. And for 5 years, I worked with 150 teachers and about 150 neuroscientists to understand the impact of drugs on children's brains. And in that time, I was able to get access to all of the information that was in the neuroscience labs that had with about dealing with things like attention, like we call it ADD and ADHD. Also things like cognition, understanding, learning, sleep, nutrition, exercise, you name it. They had all the answers, but they were based on rabbits and monkeys and rats and cats and mice and lice and stuff, but not in children. They only dealt with children if they had crises like brain tumors or, you know, something like that, autism. But the point is that information was available, but it was not translated into process or practice that I could use as a parent or you could use as a teacher. And that's how I ended up here.
And you are all about application. And I love that. I love that. And so let's get into the brain a little bit. A lot of times parents, and you know, I'm a parent. Did I send you my son's book yet? Did you have that one?
Yes, I did. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I'm so happy that you will hopefully help me with Sean's next book about the brain and celebrating our brain and us knowing more about our brain. What is going on in the brain when we have that child either in our home or in our class that is seemingly upset? You know, what as educators and parents, you know, do you want us to know to do first?
There's two things. The first one is physical, and the second one then is going to be emotional. But let's talk about the physical one first. When information comes in, everybody knows it comes in through the five senses, and like touch and smell and hearing and sound and all of that and vision. And when it does come in, it's processed in certain places. And most of the information gets through easily enough because there's no problem. But some information passing through the what's called the amygdala, and it's amygdala because it looks like an almond, and Latin for almond is amygdala. And there's one in each hemisphere, a tiny little nut thing. And that's basically the gateway. And if that almond or that amygdala is hyperactive, and it can be hyperactive because you said, hey, how come you didn't clean your room last night? Or how come you're not wearing the right clothes? Or put on those other shoes, or, you know, your homework isn't finished. All that stuff that causes a child to be a little bit aggressive or reactive. The amygdala can be a little bit hypersensitive and hyperactive then. And if it does, it's going to route information not to the prefrontal cortex where the brain can do higher order thinking and executive function, things like predicting and planning and all of that. What it's going to do is send it to the back of the brain where it's going to be in a reactive state, like all you've got there is freeze, fight, flight, and fawn. Those four Fs are very critical for us to know as parents and teachers. And when a child is in freeze, you know, you look at the child and you say, look, you've been sitting there for 20 minutes with the pen in your hand. You've written nothing. What's going on? And the child looks at you and you think, oh, my goodness, the lights are on, but there's nobody home. Child is frozen. There's nothing happening. And then you know what fight means, the kid is fighting or screaming or kicking or whatever, aggressive. And then flight. Oh, I don't feel good. I need to go to the bathroom. I need to go to the school nurse. I need to sharpen my pencil. I want a drink of water. Anything but do the work. And sometimes they can fly into their telephones, into their iPads or whatever, and do games. That's another way of flight. And then fawn is very difficult to notice and monitor because that kid is trying to figure out, how do I just keep the status quo? I don't want anybody to be sad or angry and miserable. I'll do anything. And I'm a people pleaser. So the four Fs are basically what a lot of children live in during the day because they're in a reactive state, because their amygdala is hyperactive. That's the physical. The second one then is more more involved in the emotional connection, because it's about how I show up in a social context. And think about a social context. It could be the kitchen. It could be the bedroom. It could be the bus, the school. It could be the cafeteria or the classroom. Everything is a social context if there are other people involved. And so when I walk into the classroom, if I don't see myself in there, oh, nobody looks like me. There's no pictures on the wall that looks like me. And they all look like somebody else. And I don't fit in here. And my brain is telling me that because my brain wants to fit in and wants to be part of and it wants to be at least accepted. And here's the interesting thing. For all of us in the Homo sapiens field, us, we meaning parents, children, teachers, it doesn't matter, all of us, we all receive genes from our parents. And the interesting thing is that mom and dad can give a gene without knowing which genes they're giving. And the children get those genes and they have no choice. They just got them. And well, let's talk about one gene in particular, the serotonin transporter gene. And serotonin is the happy gene. That's where if you've got serotonin, yeah, life is good. If you don't, you can be a little bit miserable and demanding and edgy and cranky and all of that. And we know people who are happy, happy people. And we know people who are not so happy people. And if you think about it, it's a lack of serotonin. And it could be also dopamine and stuff. But we'll just focus on serotonin today. And if mom gives, and there are three possibilities for the parents giving these genes. If mom gives a short expression of that gene, that child will have a short from mom. If dad also gives a short, then you've got a child who's got short. That's what that child looks like. If on the other hand, mom gives a long and dad gives a long, then you've got a long. That child is a different child from the short child. And now there's one in the middle, which I am a middle child. I got a short and a long from them. And so I'm a long short, meaning that the short child has less serotonin than the child who got a lot of it from the long expression, which means that in life, some children will be less connected and less amiable and less what I would consider to be resilient, because the long child is very resilient and they tend to be called dandelions because they can survive all kinds of crazy things in school and home and at work and in play, and yet they'll do fine. And like a dandelion, it'll grow in a crack in the concrete. That's the way we look at that child. The other child and on the other side, the short child, that child is very sensitive and is expensive to raise. You'll find that child is at the principal's office a lot. You're going in to talk to teachers because you're the parent saying, what's wrong now? And every week there's something going on, missing school, not finishing homework, not happy at home. I got the short end of the pizza again. How come he gets more than me? All that kind of stuff is happening in that child's life. And they have more allergies and earaches and all kinds of things that cause medical issues happening as well. So it's an expensive child to raise. Imagine the child says, you know, I want to join the swim team. And you spend a lot of money and you join the club and the kid goes to the swim team. And the first day, some kid says something about, you know, you're wearing that swim trunk. Or the coach says something about a stroke and he says, I don't want to do swim anymore. And you think, wait a while, I just spent $400 on swimming stuff. Are you want to stop now? He says, yeah. And that child will never swim again. And then he says, well, maybe I want to do soccer. And you say, whoa, wait a while, that's more expensive. So now he spends $600 on boots and clothes and all that. And he goes to the soccer field and he's practicing. And the coach says, hey, kick the ball with the other foot. And he says, I don't want to play soccer anymore. And that's it. And you say, well, I've spent so much money and you can't play and you can't swim. And that child just can't fit in because it's a very sensitive child. And the people in his life who don't know about sensitive and resilience are causing the child to be reactive. And the brain shuts down and says, I am not going to do this anymore.
I'm thinking about my own household and my own, you know, students and everything. I'm like, oh, was that this, you know, even myself, I thought I was very sensitive growing up and just really like just high empathy. But I was also very resilient. And my mom always taught us that we had to stick through something because we were free and reduced lunch. So we just couldn't quit in anything. But that's good to know of the structures going on under the hood and how they could be playing out as far as personality wise, correct?
Right. And the interesting thing is that you sound like you're like me, a half and half. You could be a little bit sensitive, a little bit resilient. But the point is we can tend to be sensitive and somebody presses my buttons, I'm going to go sensitive. If somebody says something else, I can go resilient. But I didn't know that. The point is I had no mental model. And so all my life, I'm in that reactive state or not based on other people's connection to me. And that's my social context. Well, if I knew it, I could just self-regulate. I can just say, I'm not going to go into that orchidial space today. I'm going to stay in the dandelion space. orchids are the children who are sensitive. So if you've got an orchid and you're trying to raise it and you don't do the right atmosphere, the right water, the right temperature, the right pH, that thing is going to wilt. So we see children wilting in front of us every day because they're not fitting in and because we haven't arranged the environment for them, which I call greenhousing those children. If you solve the orchid child on the first day of school, you're going to have a great school. If you don't solve the orchid child on that first day of September, your year in school will be a disaster. And teachers know that every year. They say, if I didn't have Mary or John in my class, the class would be so easy to teach. Well, it's the wrong approach because you're teaching to the dandelion children. Teach to the orchid children and you've got the whole thing solved. It's very simple.
Interesting. So what are some tactics? And so one of them is emotional regulation. And I think this is a new term. I know definitely in the corporate world, but definitely in K-12 with SEL learning and what does that look like? How important is it for us to have the tools to emotionally regulate? What is the first step that people can employ today?
Good. I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, emotional regulation is really critical. And even today, we have to emotionally regulate. You're driving to work on the freeway and somebody cuts you off. You have to emotionally regulate. You can't go out and shoot that person. And, you know, it happens every day, but you shouldn't do that. And the point is you take a deep breath and you say things like, maybe they're going out to the hospital because somebody's sick, you know, so I give them that space. But if they cut you off a second time, the same car, you're going to be back in that same crisis. This time I'm going to get out and you know, choke him. Well, yeah, that's life. We have to be able to emotionally regulate ourselves. And when we have a mental model and realize that we're on a continuum, that we can be very sensitive or very resilient, and it's a line. And then you see, where am I on the line? I'm here or here. Well, where do you want to be? Just physically shift yourself there. And it's a visual mental model. But when you do that, it's easier to be able to do it. And the other thing, of course, is, I'm going to have to step over here and pick this up and show you because you need to see this. You can still listen to me. But when I talk about emotional regulation, I'm talking duct tape. Duct tape your mouth. And it's around children. The first thing we want to say is, why? And then suddenly, and so, yeah, I duct tape my mouth and I don't say the thing that I want to say, because if I do, I'm going to cause the child not to do what I want, but the exact opposite, the reactive, involuntary, oppositional and aggressive stuff that I don't want the child to do. I'm going to cause it because I just said something. Hey, I told you, sit there and don't do that and blah, blah, blah. Stop doing that. And my body language, my voice, my words cause the child to have amygdala hijack. And now everything is going to the back brain, which is freeze, fight, flight, and fawn. And I did it with my body language and with my words. So instead of that, I pretend I've got duct tape. I say nothing. And I wait, take a deep breath. And here's the interesting thing. And watch this, because you will feel it. When I stop and I do this, and I hug myself, you feel it as well because you've got mirror neurons, and all your listeners will feel it because they can't not feel it unless their mirror neurons are broken. And that too is a crisis for some children. Their mirror neurons haven't kicked in yet. They haven't, because all of these in the brain need structures. And if the structures aren't there, the mirror neurons might not be engaging yet. And so some children might need practice at that. So yeah, as a teacher, I'm going to help them to grow those mirror neurons. And we teach young children to be able to engage with each other in times of stress and use their mirror neurons to breathe together and to play together and to stretch together and just let that whole air system take over and feel your inner ease in the body. So you've got disease and ease. We want some of the ease, the good stuff.
This is so wonderful. My previous episode, episode 66, I sat down with Dr. Michael Platt out of the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative over at University of Pennsylvania or Penn State, one of those. And he talks about synchrony, like getting the brain in synchrony. And so that sounds a lot like mirror neurons, like getting our brains to be kind of like on the same wavelength. That is amazing. And so wondering how parents and teachers and team leaders, right? Anyone over a team that we can really put into our practice, just brain health for those who we lead? Like, what do you, like, how do you see us starting meetings, starting our classroom day, starting our day at home to make sure that the brains are ready to learn?
Yeah, so this is very good. And let's talk about synchrony for 1 second, because it all applies. So when I walk into a group of people, adults or children, and I look at who's there, and I'm not seeing people as, oh, that's a good looking clothes, or that's a nice person, or that's a dangerous looking person, because that's what my brain is doing. It's like, oh, my God, that's going to be a crisis. Oh, that person is not healthy. And I'm making judgments because the brain is going to do that. But me as an adult saying, you can't do that. That's not acceptable for a start, but it's also wrong. And so, but my brain is a survival brain, because we have capacity as Homo sapiens. We are, first of all, we're going to survive ourselves. It's going to protect me. And if there's any danger in that room, I need to know. Some people have to sit with their backs to the wall in the corner because they are not going to be, you know, they're hypervigilant. And it's because of previous experiences they've had. It's safer for me to sit here. I don't want to be in front of that window. I want to be over here by that wall. And that's a choice, because the brain needs to survive. But here's an interesting thing. When I look at my audience, I think, okay, Sensitive, resilient. And you can see it already, because we know people. And if you know your audience, you even know. And in every single audience, no matter where you go, you'll have at least 20%, 15 to 20% of people who are short serotonin transporter gene people. In other words, there'll be very sensitive people in the room, and then there'll be people who are resilient. And here's the bad news. The resilient people cannot see the sensitive people. They say, what's wrong with them? Pull it together, pull yourself up. There will be consequences. And the other people are saying, man, that's so sad. I really need to help these people. Very different people in the same room. And if they don't know that they are that kind of person, then you're going to have clashes. You're going to have problems at work. You're going to have problems at school. But if people have a mental model about resilience and sensitivity, then at least they can figure out how to engage and actually collaborate together for better performance. And then, of course, you've got the middle grounders who will, depending on the day, either go with the sensitive people or go with the resilient people. And what happens in many meetings is that the resilient people, who keep plowing ahead because there will be consequences and we have to do it this way, and they win the game, because the sensitive people are afraid to talk, and they're so already pent up with anger that they're not saying their stuff. And when they do, it sounds like they're angry and aggressive. And that causes a lot of crisis in workplaces, because people don't understand why you can't see it the way I see it. Because I'm a resilient person, and man, we're going to do this. And so that happens in schools too. For teachers who are resilient, they don't understand the children who are sensitive. But the sensitive teachers are already burned out, because they can see so much struggle and chaos in schools today that they are giving more than they have. And so that's why burnout happens so easily for sensitive teachers. The resilient teachers say, we'll have to have consequences, punishments, and just get them out of here. Those kids shouldn't be in school. They're not ready. And yeah, that happens. We send kids into these other schools, which are the last school in the block, the alternative schools, and then finally into juvenile centers and punishment, and sometimes out on the streets. And those are our orchids. And here's the crazy thing, Janine. Those children who are the sensitive children are the Bill Gates and the Steve Jobs of the world. They're also the homeless. They're also the suicides. They're also the prisons. Because the children who are not able to handle home life and school life because they're so sensitive will always end up finding their, what I would call their greenhouse. It could be out on the streets in gangs and in alcohol and drugs and whatever else, because they say, we will take care of you. We will greenhouse you. We will love you. Just get me some more drugs and I will love you. That's what happens to children who are 12, 13, 14, 15, running away from school, running away from home, because they have to survive, because their brain says that's the only way you can survive.
There's so much there, so much there. And talking about, you know, my work is in intercultural creativity and looking at how culture affects our creative potential, but also affects the way we see the creative potential of others. And this is a whole new avenue of looking at the sensitivity and resilience of people and ourselves and how it affects the way we interact with others. One thing that really stuck with me that I saw, because I took your training, I am officially brain-centric design certified, so proud to claim that. And I saw this within the training, and it's also on the back of your book, Brain-Centric Design, that you co-authored with Rich Carr, who was on the show as well. You have a testimonial from a man named Alan Brazee. And it says, there must be a way for hard heads like myself to learn how to learn that doesn't include years of solitary confinement. Right. If you're reading this, then you've likely found it. If brain-centric design had been a resource for my younger self, perhaps this testimonial would have been written by Master Chief Brazee, U.S. Navy, rather than inmate 797180, Washington State inmate Alan Brazee. And then I read this on the back, and then I read his whole inscription in the book and in the class, and I literally started crying. That hit me hard, because I wonder how many people are sitting in our jails and our prisons that just needed this type of brain-centric design learning that would have saved them from being inmate 797120 and all the other numbers. What are your thoughts about that?
So there's two things. First of all, there's a lot of research today that's available at public that connects people who are homeless and people who are in prison with something that happened in third grade in school. In other words, that teacher just pushed me out. I was isolated over here. I wasn't allowed to play with the other kids, and I was sent out to a special blah blah whatever. And I wasn't allowed to go to recess. I was punished. And when you start to punish these sensitive children, you shut them down. So the first thing you have to realize is that neither rewards or punishments work for sensitive children. Now, that's a huge thing to understand, because you think rewards should work. I mean, if I give them a cookie or attaboy stuff, and you see this in all the coaching, you go to games and there's all these attaboys and good man, good boy, good girl, you did that right, blah, blah. All that stuff is absolutely dangerous for children. You have to reward the effort, not the child. That's a big shift. Now, for the resilient children, it doesn't matter. You can reward them or punish them. They don't care. It doesn't matter. So, but it seems that for 50% of people, because that's the audience you're dealing with, 50% of people, it's okay to reward. So therefore, it's okay. It doesn't matter for them. But for the other 50%, that's those sensitive and the middle grounders, they cannot survive rewards or punishments. And that's why... And this is crazy, but if you go to NAEP, which is the National Association of Educational Performance, and it's been taking data from the 1950s or 60s all the way through to today, and you look at their numbers, they've never gotten over 50% of performance. Never. And it gets worse year by year. And you look at different states, and some states are so low, and this is America with all that money and all that brains, and yet they can't get even 50% of their kids up over that baseline. Well, when I work with schools, and I'm not doing the job, I'm helping teachers and they do the work, right? I'm not the person doing it. So it's not my effect, it's their effect. And when we work with schools and they say things like, well, we want to make sure we get good numbers at the end of the year. That's for, academic outcome. You say, don't worry about the academic outcome. We're going to focus on effect, which is emotional, as you say, SEL. We're going to talk about effect and have fun with this. And if you're not having fun, you're going to lose 50% of your people. That's the first thing. And when we do, we get scores up in the 90s and 100s. You can get 100% retention with children if you do this correct. If you don't, you will have the NAEP scores from the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the ways up, and getting worse year over year. And it's called the Nation's Report Card. Every 1st of October, you'll see it. And you can go back and look at them all and verify this yourself. Never above 50%.
And that's huge, because we want our students to do well, but not just academically. Well, we want them to do well in life with all these areas. And that's why I love your work and the work that you're learning from, as well as far as the other research that talks about the power of emotion, you know, emotional intelligence, emotional agility, emotional resilience. What is going on with there? And you have a formula that you talk about as well. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, this is quite a shock for me, because all my heroes were educators, of course. And one of the famous people that I always loved to talk about was Thorndike. And Thorndike was around the 1916, 17, up to 20s, so 100 years ago. And he worked at Columbia University in New York City. And there's a Thorndike Hall there today. And he did a famous study with a cat. And the cat... He made the cat hungry, first of all, and then he put some food outside the cage and he put the cat into the cage. And there was a way for the cat to get out, but the cat had to learn it. And the first time the cat was flailing around, and by accident it got out. And the next day it got out a bit faster. And then 4 days later, like, the cat could get out by itself. It knew how to get out. And he called that the law of effect, which is basically how the cat learned to get out. The very first law of learning. Now, most people have never heard of Thorndike, and most people don't think about the law of effect. But the crisis was this. Back in 1920, when he did this 100 years ago, people didn't think that cats had emotions. So they changed the word affect to effect. Affect is emotion in psychology, and effect is result. And today in schools, we look for effect, the results. What's the academic output? Instead of saying, what's the emotional connection? And so that's where SEL comes in. And that's been a very hot topic for a while. But it should never, it was in the 1920s that the mistake was made to change the A to E. It was a simple change, affect to effect. And you know that when people write the word affect or effect and they're writing something, they're always wondering, should that be an A or an E? Because it's a hard one to know. Is it a verb or is it an adjective or is it a noun or what? And so it's a little bit grammatical. But for psychologists, it's about emotions. And now let's talk about brain for a second. And we'll look at the triune version of the brain. A lot of people don't like doing this, but it's a simplified way of seeing brain. The idea that you have got, first of all, that cerebellum, that old brain, which is like 300 or 400 million years in evolution. And that's where we are the survivors. So let's talk about the brains in a triune. It's a simplified version of looking at the brain. And we'll start with the cerebellum, because the cerebellum is 300 or 400 million years in evolution, and it's the part of our brain, yes, that we would call our primal brain. It has instincts in there for survival and for keeping me safe, and reactive stuff. Like, if I hear a scream of brakes on the street, I'm going to already be gone. I'm not going to say, oh, I think a truck is going to run me over, I better do something. No, I'd be dead by then. I'm already gone. I'm hiding behind a tree. And then I think, wow, that was crazy. I almost got hit by a truck. So the brain goes faster than our thinking system. Our thinking system is up here, but the primal brain back here. Now, most people don't know that 60% of your neurons are in that brain. And so all of our children have very strong primal reactive brains that they bring into the classroom or back to the kitchen with you and mom and dad. And they say, yeah, sure, I'm not going to do that, because it's the brain saying that would be unsafe for me or something. And the point I'm making here is that the next part of the brain then is the emotional limbic brain. And that's about 30 million years in evolution. And that's the part of the brain that we need to merge with our primal brain and give children opportunities to make mistakes in there, connecting that primal brain of survival with this emotional brain. And some kids will have connections easy and other kids will have connections more difficult. So build empathy and compassion and opportunities to discuss and make mistakes in that space, grow the structures, because all of our brain, and we didn't talk about this, but all of our brain is based on 100 billion neurons, but the connections that those neurons can make, which is white matter structures. And those white matter structures are not born with the children. They're going to happen with experience over time. So as parents and teachers, we need to give the children opportunities to connect that primal brain with the emotional brain. And if you don't, you'll have people who are not very emotional and who can say things like, well, yeah, run over that cat. That's easy. It doesn't matter. Well, some kids will say, I can't do that. That's going to hurt me. I feel empathy for somebody who's going to do damage like that. And so that emotional capacity will have to be connected to the primal capacity. And then finally, up here in front, our 3-million-year-old brain is our Homo sapiens brain for being able to predict and plan and activate conversations and arguments that are, you know, conducive to performance together. That kind of work is very important for all of us. And yet that's the one that's the most furthest away from our primal brain. It takes 25 or 26 years to make all those connections. And so why would you expect a 12-year-old or a 7-year-old to do stuff up here when they're still trying to figure out their primal and their emotional? And that's our job as parents and teachers. Give them opportunities to make mistakes in those spaces, because that's where the connections are being built. And when they make mistakes, they learn. When they don't make mistakes, they're not learning as much.
And that's so important to know, and to really have a culture and a space in our home, in our classroom, and in our organizations to allow mistakes and not stigmatize mistakes, or I even call them challenges or attempts. You know, I'm trying to be very careful with the vocabulary that I use around myself and my son, and looking at that, that is so much there. Now, going into a term that you mentioned during our training about brain fertilizer, what is the brain fertilizer and how do we build it?
Yeah, so the BDNF, the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, again, it's like every neuron needs help to be successful at communicating, but also to have that dendritic arborization, that all those connectors. And you can take images of children who have really healthy brains and look at them and you'll see, whoa, that's a good looking brain. And then you can put up another child alongside of it, and that child has been abused, neglected, abandoned, you name it, all the stuff that can happen in a home and in a school. And the two brains look very different. And these brains looked almost the same at birth, but now 2 or 3 or 5 years later, they're very different. And the reason is that the experience the child has in the environment at home or in school or in the playground is impacted by what's happened, but also by the child's genetic capacity. If I'm sensitive, I'm going to have the same experience with you, but it'll have a different impact on me because all of our brains are unique. So when we solve that orchid child in the classroom, in the playground, in the home, we help all children to excel. And one thing I didn't finish a while ago when I was talking about that is these orchid children are the children who pass out the regular children. I mean, we talk about Gen 8 classrooms. These are classrooms where most of the children reside. These are the easy places. And then there's special ed and there's all that stuff beyond. They pull children out and later on they push children out. Well, the point is that those children that they pull out need that extra time or need that extra help to get what they say. There's a lag in between their learning and their capacity and their abilities and all that. Well, guess what? It's just structures that they haven't built yet. It's not that they need to be punished for that. It's that the structures weren't there because mom and dad didn't have the opportunity to teach them about that. They didn't have enough vocabulary. They didn't have experiences. They might have been stuck on a TV all day. They were, you know, somebody else was taking care of them and they didn't do a good job. Whatever, those children's brains were not prepared properly for the architecture and the brain for what happens in a typical classroom. So instead of sending them out and doing crazy things like that, if you can engage that child with programs that are fun and representing the level that they're at, you will have great successes. And we see this every single day with our teachers. And teachers do amazing things when they have the power and the freedom to do that. But if they're structured in a system that says you've got to reward them and punish them, then you're going to lose 50% every single day. We have one program which was so successful, it still boggles my mind how the teacher thought about it and then implemented it and then had success. So imagine children who come to school and they can't even pick up a pen. They can't write their names. They're clumsy. They're not able to engage with other children because they've had no experiences and they haven't got the structures in their brains yet. And you think, oh my God, these children are so far behind at age 6 that what are we going to do? They'll never catch up. And they won't. They can catch up unless we do something important. And the crisis is they have these IEPs and other programs where the children are pulled out to do catch up work. Well, the minute you do that, you label the child. Oh, I'm a pullout child, or I'm a SPED child, or I'm a IEP or something. And the kids know that. At the same other side of the school, you've got these children who are labeled as gifted. And so, oh, well, they're gifted and I'm an IEP. I'm no good. And the children suddenly have an identity at age 5 or 6 that they're not good enough. And believe it or not, their brain reinforces them every day that they are not good enough. And so when they say that, I can't do math. I hate science. I'm no good at school and school sucks. When they say that, they're just representing what their brain tells them every single day. because that's how the brain works. So this teacher said to her colleague in school, look, every day at 11 o'clock, you've got a play piece where the children have free play and you have to sit there and watch them. So instead of that, would you please give them to me for a half an hour every day and I will do a program with them to help the children to catch up and you'll have the time off. And so the teacher says, sure, I can take a break. And so what she did was she went out to the local stores and she got all their empty shoe boxes and small boxes and all that. And then in each box, she put two pieces. She put a cognitive factor and a small motor skill factor. So it could be any kind of a game that was cognitive and small motor skill, very intentional. And then a small motor skill might be you have to use a tweezers to pick up a small bead and put it over there. And that's hard for children who can't even pick up a pen and write their name, right? It's very difficult because they haven't got their small motor. That's parietal. They don't have their small motor skills. The structures are not grown yet and connected. And so then they have to do some cognitive factor, maybe add this to that or move it over here before they can figure out what to use the small motor skills with. And then she put that into a box, a gift box, and wrapped it and put a little bow on it and gave it to each of the children. And every day they came in, they got a gift. And they opened it, it's like, wow, little game, my goodness. And then they play the game and they win. And then they put the box back. And the next day she wraps it up again and gives it to a different kid. And there's hundreds of boxes, all gifts that the children get. And at the end of that semester, the children had passed out the gen ed kids. These are the kids who were lagging, who couldn't do anything. They had passed them out so much so that the gen ed kids were complaining that they were having more fun than them. And they wanted to go to the pullout class. In other words, if you know what you're doing and you're building structures, you can be way more effective with all children. And the point is that if your model is reward and punishment, you're going to lose 50%. If your model is cognitive, you can actually have all of our children perform at their potential.
And see, that's powerful. I looked at the work of Dr. Kenneth Wesson as well. And he said this, basically the same thing, that there's assets and deficits. Basically missing structures is exactly what you're saying in the brain. If we can identify those and help them build those, that's where it is. And he also mentioned the work of, I don't know if it's Dr. or Mr. Breyer, of how the neuroscience lab is a bridge too far from classroom.
Yeah.
And us knowing more. Because, you know, as a teacher, I never went through any type of brain connection of what the brains were doing when I was going through my teacher ed program. What do you think teachers and parents should do in addition to reading the book that I would love to publish about the brain? But what do you think that we could do to get ready if we don't want to go to neuroscience, you know, get our bachelor's in neuroscience, but what can teachers and parents do to really incorporate this into our parenting and our classroom?
Yeah, this is a good question. And of course, John Brewer did write that famous paper, A Bridge Too Far. And he was right. Back then, we didn't have enough. But what happened in the meantime, that was back in the 90s, early 90s, maybe late 80s, I forget when he put out the paper. But the point is that, and it was a good paper, I read it and I agree with it. But in the decade of the brain, which was 1990 to 2000, there was so much information came out. And as a teacher and as a parent, I looked at that information, I thought, oh my goodness, every single thing I knew about the brain was wrong. Every single thing I'd been taught about the brain was wrong. I thought that I only used about 10% of my brain. And I actually thought maybe I used less because I used to party quite a lot. And I thought maybe I've just burned up all my brain cells. I also thought that when you got to 25, that was all downhill from there. And that, you know, you could build up a great brain up to 25 and then boom, it's going to be the rest of your life is just, and by the time you're old, like me now, that there's nothing left. Absolutely wrong. It's like, are you kidding me? The brain is so plastic. And especially with children in our elementary and middle schools, those kids' brains are so pliable and so malleable. We can do things to reverse all the crisis in their lives every day if we know what we're doing. And I teach my teachers how to engage with these children, and we have amazing successes, really great successes. But at the same time, and this is the crisis, 90% of our teachers are still rewarding and punishing because they're using things like PBIS and other programs, which sound great, positive behavior, you know, intervention support. It sounds fantastic, but it's based on rewards and punishments. And when you go cognitive, you just walk away from that world. It's a very different space. And the children excel, and we get people to their potential, which is very easy to do.
Yes, yes. And as a parent, it's like, that's what, you know, I will admit, we sometimes do that as well. Like, you know, if you take your nap, you'll get this. But I try to say, you know, if you do this, it's because you're a good person and you want to make a good choice. But to a three-year-old, that doesn't really roll over too well.
So let me say a couple of things about rewarding three-year-olds. So when a child, you can reward children at that age, but mostly they'll want just hugs and touches, because mom's cooing and googling with them is all they really want. They want to be part of and touched and all that, and held and cuddled and all. That's the most important thing at that age. But when you say to them, if you do this, I'll give you a cookie, and you'll get away with it. They'll do it for your cookie. And the next day they'll want, give me 5 cookies. And the next day they'll want, give me 20 cookies. And after a while you have to buy a bicycle, and then you have to buy a car. And you know, that token economy stuff is okay if there's no cognitive load involved. But if there's any cognitive load, that means doing math or science or solving a problem, the more cognitive load, the less you need to reward. Because if you reward them, the performance goes downhill. That's been proven for 50 years of research. And yet we do it every day. If you do this, you get you wear jeans on Friday. If you do this, you can have lunch with Miss Johnson. If you do this, you're going to go to recess. If you don't, you're going to go to, you know what I'm saying, detention. And that's the stuff that we do to cajole and to frighten children, and it does not work. And as I say before, it doesn't matter for the resilient children, because they don't care if you punish them or reward them, but the other children do. And here's one last thing that's really important. So I walk into a classroom and there's a kid over here, and he's throwing something out the window, we'll say, something that you don't want to happen. And I say, John, don't, da. And my voice changes, my body language changes, and everything about me now is punishment and all negative, right? And John looks at me and he's laughing, because like he's done this before and he knows that it doesn't mean anything. He's resilient. But there's 5 sensitive children over here that I'm not even talking to. And they pick up on my body language and my tone and my voice. And they think, oh, Miss Johnson is upset today, so she's going to pick on me. And Miss Johnson didn't even look at them. In other words, the sensitive child is upset by something that happened remotely over here to somebody else. And that's the point that most teachers miss and parents miss. You say something to Mary and Peter is crying in his bedroom all night.
Yes, yes. Is that connected to social contagion, just how people can kind of catch your emotional?
It's based on the serotonin reactive event that if I'm a sensitive child, I pick up on all the sensitive. They're picking up on Ukraine right now. They're picking up on the homelessness on the streets. They're picking up on the crisis about dad has lost his job. They're picking up because they are sensitive people. Mm-hmm. And their life's trajectory is changed because we didn't say, you know, Mary, it's not about you. I still got you. I love you. You're okay. You have to say that a million times a day to those children, and they have to feel part of. And here's another thing, Maslow's hierarchy, that says, you know, that the bottom line of that is based on having enough food and water and shelter and all that. And then you're up on top, you've got self-actualization, and in the middle, you've got sense of belonging. Believe me, it's wrong. Sense of belonging is first for these sensitive people. For the resilient people, it doesn't matter. The Maslow hierarchy doesn't matter. But for the sensitive kids, you better put that sense of belonging first. If I don't belong in your classroom, if I don't belong in your kitchen, then I will find my belonging in the streets, in drugs and alcohol, and sometimes in homelessness and prisons and cutting, you name it. That we see it every day with these children. It's because of that sense of belonging and that emotional connection that's missing.
Well, this is amazing. I really didn't. Because in this book, I don't think you've had the orchids and dandelions. You don't talk about that. But in your other book,
yeah, this is why I did the book for the children. The first book is about learning, because most of my research happened with adult educators in industry, and the way I look at that today is look at these children who are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and they're still dysregulated because we haven't grown the structures for them yet. Well, if they don't get regulated in schools like we should, then they grow up and they get jobs out in the street with Microsoft or Amazon or you name it. And now they're 26, 37, 48, and they're still dysregulated. And that costs HR a lot of money because HR is going to deal with them on Monday mornings. They can't show up because they're hungover. On Friday, they're leaving early because they got stuff going on, and they're sensitive people and they're broken people because they're still unregulated. They're dysregulated. And so we can fix that at age 47. It's a little bit more difficult because they have myelinated fixedness and rigidity that's based on what their experience has been. In schools, they're so malleable. We can do it there easily. But we can also do it at you know, the Boeing company or Microsoft or Amazon, you name it, wherever people are. And it's not that they don't need it, it's that they're not getting it. And they're still resilient, they're still sensitive in there, and they don't understand why they're not happy in their jobs or their lives or their marriages. And it's because they haven't figured out that whole regulation thing yet.
Ah, so important, so important. And I know that you do work in corporations, but also in K-12. And I see it too, because just because of my background from teaching K-5 and doing 6-12 and then working at the university and then, you know, being incorporated on board, just really seeing the whole pipeline. And that's why I tell people it's so sad that we don't put a lot of this, you know, training into the 0 through 12 years, 0 through 18 years, because by the time they get to adulthood, we can still help. And but the words of Frederick Douglass come to mind, it's easier to build strong children than fix and repair broken men and women. And that's so true. Let's build strong children, going in alignment with your metaphor of building structures, right? And that's so important of how do they have the structures and the tools to emotionally regulate. So I'm definitely looking to learn and grow more in that area to be an assistant. So just lastly, you have a wonderful training program. You have amazing books. If people wanted to learn more from you and more about you, where can they go?
Yeah, so I have a website called brainbasedsolutions.org. Brain-based solutions is all one word. It's a long word, but it's and it's plural. Brain-based solutions. and the you know, the interesting thing is, of course, that the teachers who embrace this, they say things like, "Are you kidding me? Why didn't you tell me sooner? Why didn't you tell me?" And then I say, "Well, there's more." And they say, "Okay, what's more?" And I tell them about long-term potentiation. And long-term potentiation is that thing that just absolutely shifts everybody, because it was discovered in 1947, and I stumbled across it in 2019, and it was called, in 1947, it was called the most exciting thing for learning ever. And basically, it causes a very important physical shift at the synapse that causes children to be able to process information faster and retain information. And if you do it properly in a classroom, you can have amazing success. So yeah, we do all of that with teachers, and they love to be in the brain space and the cognitive learning models.
I see. And I love it. Another point that you brought up during your training is important to activate all the lobes in different ways. And so I was doing that intuitively, but watching you and your partner, Rich, just really infuse that into the learning was so important on how do you really engage a brain well. And definitely, if you're looking to get more information on that, go and check out his work. So thank you so much for stopping by the Create and Grow podcast. We will have all the links for people to go check out your website, your books, your certification program for being a brain-centric designer, right? That's what you and Rich call it. And then your website and work as well. So we are the diamonds here. We believe that everyone is a diamond. Everyone should shine bright. What is a diamond thought or a word of wisdom that you can leave us with?
Yeah. So for me, again, it has to be structure before function. And structure means that white matter connections in the brain, and function means it can be anything, like having a relationship. It could be playing soccer, riding a bike. You have to the structure first, and you shouldn't punish a child because they don't have the structure and they can't do the function. So the kid can't play soccer. You shouldn't punish them. You build the structure and then they'll play soccer.
I love it. I love it. And it really forces us to look at this a different way and to have grace in the process that we were learning, because there's a term called the curse of knowledge, where we think that people should know what we know. And they don't. They're missing those structures, and they need time to build those structures. So thank you so very much. I told you I bring you the top minds in the world, and you hopefully you have grown some of your neural pathways, because neurons that fire together wire together, right?
Indeed. Thank you so much, Janine. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. And we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us at the Create and Grow podcast. We hope that you obtain some amazing gems and are able to see how you are creative and how we are more creative when we work well together. If you wish to learn more about our organizational training programs and professional development for companies, organizations, schools, and districts, visit cafestrategies.com. That's C-A-F-F-E strategies.com, where we have amazing keynote speakers and certified facilitators on board to help your organization learn how to build a climate of inclusion and innovation. We have groundbreaking book titles in our online bookstore that lay out the 7 gems of intercultural creativity, as well as our children's books that inspire the innate creative ability of our little ones. We thank you again for joining us and remind you to shine bright like a diamond. See you next time.